So, as Kim said, I'm Greg Brown. I'm a professor of exercise science at the University of Nebraska at Kearney, here in the middle of the state of Nebraska. I got to put a little pitch out for Kearney right now. Okay. The sandhill crane migration is happening. And I know not a lot of people are bird nerds, but if you look up sandhill crane migration, Kearney, Nebraska, it simply is amazing. Right now, there's about 500,000 sandhill cranes in between Kearney and Grand Island. It's like a 50-mile stretch of the Platte River. We've got a half a million cranes. It's going to peak out here in a week or two with a lot more. It's pretty awesome. And I'll extend an invitation. If any of you come to Kearney for the crane season, which is end of February, beginning of March, let me know. I'll show you the good spots to see the cranes. But the other important thing to remember is you can't spell drunk without UNK. So if that's your hobby, apparently this is the place for you as well. So yeah, a little derisive humor here about the university. So just want to present this research that I did, which is the first in what I hope is going to be several of confirming common sense publications that I've got. And so you can see the title on that. We're looking at sex-based differences in track running in 8 and under and 9 and 10 year old age groups. Collaborated on this with my friends Brandon and Ina Shaw. They're at the University of Essex. Nope, sorry, scrolling too fast. To set this up, and so a lot of you that were at the ICONS conference this summer saw this. You can see a number of quotes here from journal article titles or journal articles basically saying there's no difference in athletic performance before puberty. I think a couple of important things here. So we have this quote from Joshua Safer arguing that, there's no difference before puberty. And if you suppress puberty, there's no difference after puberty if somebody's transgender. And then this is a quote from in the documents in AM versus Indianapolis Public Schools, where the opposition's lawyers are arguing that stating there is a difference before puberty is purely speculative. And those are the kind of things that really motivated me to take a look at this. And one of the things I want to point out when people say there's no difference in athletic performance before puberty, they're ignoring a lot of research showing there's differences in physical fitness between boys and girls before puberty. And so I've got 21 different papers up there. I've got about 36 papers I've identified overall. Any of us that did the president's physical fitness test, which most of us probably hated, right? But you can go and look at those scores for the president's physical fitness test. And for the 50th percentile, the boys are faster, the boys are stronger. For the 85th percentile, the boys are faster, the boys are stronger. So this idea that, oh, there's no evidence that boys are faster and stronger than girls really doesn't hold a lot of water. But you can see in those articles in the court cases, they're like, well, that's physical fitness. That's not athletic performance. That's not competition. So those don't count, which is just completely backwards. Because in adults, if we say somebody has higher physical fitness, we expect they're going to do better in sports, right? But for some reason, that doesn't work in kids. So I don't understand the logic there. Now, the other thing is, if we look at the records, this is from USA Track and Field, the all-time best performances at the Junior Olympic Championships, which is a national championship for age groups. I mean, they do all the ages starting 8 and under, 9 to 10 year old, and 11, 12 on like that. If we look at the 8 and under age group, the boys are faster in every running event, averaging 4.3%, as little as 1% to as high as 7%. Long jump 20% farther, shot put 14% farther, and mini javelin 44% farther. Which, I look at that 20%, 14%, 44%, and how can somebody really say, oh, those are meaningless or those are inconsequential? That's a huge difference in performance between boys and girls. But yet, some people, for some reason, keep ignoring this. We've got real similar records from the AAU, from School Sport Australia. You can look at also the USA Track and Field 8 and under and 9 and 10 year old, just overall youth records. And consistently, the boys are running faster, they're throwing farther, they're jumping higher. And again, this is one of those things that I just don't get it. We can look at the Olympic records. Nobody has any problem saying men are faster than women based on Olympic records or NCAA records or high school records. Okay, well, some people have a problem with that, but they want to deny reality anyway. But then we get to children, and suddenly, even people that know better are kind of turning over and saying, well, we don't know if boys are faster than girls, which is kind of crazy to me. If we look at the only real paper I know of evaluating this, and this is Handelman's paper, which again, notice the title there where he's saying sex differences in athletic performance emerge coinciding with the onset of male puberty. But yet, when he analyzed data for age 10 and under in running, and he took just all sorts of records and everything and compiled them into one running event, basically. So he had long distance, short distances, but still showing the boys were 3% faster than girls at age 10, which is before puberty. And then you can see the increases after age 11, 12. And so we get to these adult style differences, but still a 3% difference. Anybody that's involved in sports knows that a 3% difference is huge. And to just be given that 3% difference because you are born male, you were conceived male, that's again, it's just crazy that that's the background that we're looking at and that this question has come up. But because of all of that, and because of the various court cases that I've written expert reports for, whether it's Seoul versus CIAC or Hecox versus Little in Idaho or some of these other court cases, when I write that, oh, we've got physical fitness differences between boys and girls, the opposition always says, well, that's fitness testing and that's not actual scholarly analysis of data. And then they point to this Handelsman paper. So again, it's just kind of interesting the things that we're dealing with in this day and age. So what my friends Brandon and Ann and I did is we collected the finishing times for the final heat, which is either the eight fastest males and females, you know, they have a preliminary heat, then the eight fastest go into the finals heat, or in events like a 1500, when they just run all the kids together, take the eight fastest there. And so we had the eight fastest boys and girls for age eight and under and nine and 10. We used the USA Track and Field National Youth Championships and the USA Track and Field National Junior Olympic Championships. So we had two track meets from every year, from the years 2016 to 2023. The events weren't held in 2020 due to COVID. And because of sometimes with disqualifications or not finishing or something like that, we still ended up with a total of 1,749 race times across 100, 200, 400, 800, 1500 meters in these eight and under and nine and 10-year-old kids. And it's a very simplistic thing that we did. I'm kind of surprised somebody hasn't thought of it before me, but I'm also hoping nobody else thinks of it for a little while so I can keep pushing out a couple of publications on this before other people scoop me. And so as I go through the slides showing the data, right, just to illustrate this a little bit. So the open circles, open blue circles, are the eight and under boys. The colored pink circles are the eight and under girls. The open blue squares are the nine to 10-year-old boys. The closed pink squares are the nine, 10-year-old girls. And this is just every one of the race times that we had there. You've got a p value, which for those of you that aren't used to statistics, basically that gives us the probability that these two are different. Typically in science, we're looking at that and saying, oh, if a p is 0.05, we can say with 95% confidence that these two groups would be different, right? And so we have a p of 0.00, which means I can say with 99.9999, some of these are going off into seven or eight significant digits before you get a number, and say, yes, there's a statistically significant difference between the boys and girls. And the other thing, as so we calculated an effect size. Effect size is a way of trying to take this difference and say, okay, so we have a significant difference. Is it meaningful? If an effect size is a 0.2, we'd call that a small effect size. If an effect size is 0.5, we'd call that moderate. And a moderate effect size really is pretty meaningful. If you get an effect size of 0.8, that's a large effect size, and that's blatantly obvious. I mean, you should be able to see that with the naked eye with an effect size of 0.8. So you can see our effect sizes here between moderate and large. And very statistically significant that lo and behold, I realize this is shocking, and nobody who ever grew up and went to school experienced this. But the 8-year-old boys are faster than the eight and under girls, and the nine to 10-year-old boys are faster than the nine to 10-year-old girls. The fastest boy is faster than the fastest girl, or was faster than the fastest girl in all of these events. And so this is for the 100 meter. And we see very similar type of thing for the 200 meter. Large effects, well, okay, moderate effect sizes. Statistically significant out to multiple decimal places, boys faster than girls. All right. And again, keep in mind, this is two track meets. Generally, if they hold the outdoor championships on one coast, they have the National Junior Olympics on the other coast to try and alternate back and forth across the country. But it was consistent across events. The boys were faster than the girls. Across meets, the boys are faster than girls. If we look at the 400 meter, again, we see the same thing. And you know, you look at this, look at these eight and under males here in the 400 meter. That fastest boy, he's running as fast as like the top five or faster girls that are a little bit older than him. And okay, we see a few girls here in the 9 to 10 year old girls that are almost as fast as the 9 to 10 year old boys, not quite, but almost. But by and large, there's a big difference. And so if we're to look at the outliers, well, okay, so we have a couple of boys that are slower than a couple of the girls. That doesn't negate sex-based differences, right? You have a couple of outliers, and that's why you do the statistics on it to help control for the outliers, and you get all these numbers. And again, in the 400 meters, the boys are faster than the girls. Look at that in the 800 meters. The boys, once again, the 8 year old boys faster than the 8 year old girls, the 9 to 10 year old boys faster than the 9 to 10 year old girls. In the paper, I used males and females because that's kind of the science speak we have to use these days. We don't want to get caught up, you know, because we might be confused about what a boy is. So be blatantly clear with males and females. It is what we've got to do. But again, look at this effect size for the 8 and under males in the 800 meter. That's blatantly obvious. You shouldn't even need statistics to detect that size of an effect size or that size of a difference between the boys and the girls. And if we look at the 1500 meter, again, we see some very large differences. Look at this. Our effect size for the 9 to 10 year old males and females, 1.08, which, all right, so 0.2 is small, 0.5 is moderate, 0.8 is large. This is gargantuan. This is Godzilla of effect sizes type of thing. And it's just, again, obviously clear. I think there was 14 boys faster than the fastest girl across these numbers. And so we see it consistently. The fastest boys are faster than the fastest girls when you're comparing the 8 year old boys to the 8 and under girls, or the 9 to 10 year old boys to the 9 to 10 year old girls. And so some highlights on this. In the 8 and under age group, the boys were 5.4 plus or minus 1.1% faster than the girls. That's a pretty big difference. It really is. In the 9 to 10 year old age group, the boys were 4.3 plus or minus 1.1% faster than the girls. If we look, just to put this in perspective, right? If some of you guys remember in swimming, when the whole body super suits came out, the non-textile swimming suits, you had the Nike Laser Racer suit and those kind of things, early 2000s, maybe 2008 or so, those improved performance by reportedly 2 to 3%. And FINA jumped on those within 2 years and they were banned because it was unfair to have a better swimming suit to give a 2 or 3% advantage. If we compare this to anabolic steroids typically are going to make somebody 5 to 20% stronger, right? Anabolic steroids are pretty well universally banned, and that's 5 to 20% stronger. That doesn't mean you're 5 to 20% faster. That doesn't mean you're throwing the ball 5 to 20% further. We know that strength improves performance. Well, here we've got these 4 to 5% average differences between boys and girls before puberty. If we look at just the fastest boys, so take the fastest boy in the 8 to 10 or 8 and under 100 meter, or the 9 to 10 year old 100 meter, compared to the same girl, 3.7% faster, right? And again, in every event, the fastest boy was faster than the fastest girl, which again, I know this is just common sense. We all know this, but now we have numbers to it. And this is published in a peer-reviewed journal, which from a scholarly standpoint, look at this in my, you know, university professor nerd, the European Journal of Sports Sciences is considered a Q1 or quartile one sports science journal. So that means it's a good journal. This paper, I'm going to brag a little bit, just this, it's crazy. And a lot of people from ICONS are responsible for helping with this. But as of right now, it is the number one paper out of 1,897 papers tracked for the European Journal of Sports Science. And it is like number 35,000 out of 2.6 million papers in sports science that are tracked, something like that. So it's got some good input or some good impact for fairly simple and common sense type of thing. One of the people asked then, so, well, yeah, you've got these sex-based differences before puberty, but why, right? And that's a really great question. And on the one hand, does it matter, right? Boys are faster than girls. How is putting boys and girls sports going to erase that, right? A lot of people are going to say, oh, it's social factors. And yes, you can find research that shows that boys engage in more rough and tumble play than girls, and boys maybe are more inclined to be physically active than girls. Some of that comes back to testosterone, and Carol Hooven has done some great stuff with that. But I'll tell you, those social factors aren't as clear as people would have you believe. A couple of really great papers out of Denmark where they looked at 6 to 7 year old boys and girls, and they did, looked at 8 to 9 year old boys and girls, and they measured their physical activity objectively with an accelerometer. And if the boys and girls were engaging in the same amount of physical activity, the boys had less body fat and a higher VO2 max. So saying that it's social doesn't necessarily account for it. I mean, yes, we know if somebody's more physically active, they should have higher physical fitness, and higher physical fitness should give somebody higher or better sports performance. But when boys and girls engage in the same amount of physical activity, the boys are fitter and probably better athletes because of that. And other than, I just like to put this question out there. If it's social factors, if society and our patriarchal society is making it so that girls aren't going to compete in sports and aren't going to be physically active, how is putting boys in girls' sports, even though the boys identify as girls, how is that going to alleviate these social factors? I think we've seen in the great report from Fair Play for Women, it's not. It's going to cause girls to stop engaging in sports, right? Some other things, though. Before puberty, males have about 10% more lean body mass than females. We know lean body mass is a driver of athletic performance. Lean body mass, that's really the engine that runs the machine. And so if just the blessing of being a male gives you 10% more lean body mass, that of course translates to more athletic performance. And here again, when we look at adults, adult human males, men, we're going to say they have about 45% more lean body mass than comparable females. And we know that explains a lot, like 30 to 70% of the difference in athletic performance. Before puberty, there are slight differences in the pelvis shape, right? Even before puberty, girls' pelvis is broader at the ischium and the acetabulum, all right? So basically where the hip socket is, that's the acetabulum. The ischium, that's the part that you sit on. Girls are a little broader there, even before puberty. And yes, it changes more at puberty. But again, that slight change in pelvis shape might give males advantages in running and jumping by giving them slight advantages in running economy or jumping economy, better musculature alignment, those types of things. Other things before puberty, males have a little bit higher lung capacity, heart size, so they have a greater cardiorespiratory capacity even before puberty. And this is in the paper by McManus and Armstrong, which is a great paper going through all of this. Unfortunately, McManus and Armstrong do say the performance differences are minimal, and then they go through all the physiology of how boys and girls are different. But they do state that these boys' higher VO2 max is supported by higher cardiorespiratory capacity. So we can explain these differences. And again, this stuff is known. It's out there. We haven't, it's just been sitting there and people haven't been paying attention to it. It's kind of what I think is going on, right? So how is this study helpful, right? How does this really help things? Well, as I said, in a lot of legal cases, a lot of legislative debates, even in scholarly papers, you'll see people saying, oh, well, there's no sex-based differences in athletic performance before puberty. And so if there's no sex-based difference before puberty, there's no need for sex-segregated children's sports. Now, this is kind of something we do need to be a little cautious with, because in some communities, you're lucky to have soccer, let alone boys and girls soccer. And so I understand that we can't dictate that we're going to have sex-segregated sports all the time. But if the option is there, if you can have boys and girls sports, then you're going to have more girls experiencing the thrill of victory, which should enhance female participation in sports, right? Going along with this, they say that this is what the opposition will tell us. Well, if there's no difference in athletic performance before puberty, then puberty blockers just maintain the status quo and keep the boys from developing an advantage, which goes back to that paper by Safer and some others saying that there's no difference before puberty. Well, there is no status quo to maintain. The boys have higher athletic performance than the girls. And so puberty blockers aren't maintaining that status quo. And in all reality, we have no idea what puberty blockers are doing. You've seen the WPATH files that have come out, various other papers. We really have no clue what's going on. So it's kind of scary they're doing that. Also, like I like to point out, you know, when they say that there's no difference, that ignores the physical fitness testing data, that ignores the records of all-time best performance. So it's not like Brandon and I are publishing something completely brand new here. But we are looking at it from a scholarly manner and looking at performance of 1,700 children. And so this, and I think it was Mike Joyner who put this on Twitter, something about how this is a real world evaluation of athletic performance in children. And this is in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. So that gives it credibility. I agree. That's not the mark of credibility. So there's not some great stuff in peer-reviewed journals, but at least gives this something, right? I hope, as I mentioned, that this is the first of several papers confirming common sense. So these two papers are also in review with the European Journal of Sports Science. I was really hoping to hear back from the journal on the shot put javelin a long jump paper by now. Don't know what's taking so long on that. I thought it would be at least back from the initial round of review. But I have heard from the editor. He thinks it's good stuff. So again, common sense there. The boys are throwing the shot put, the javelin, and they're long jumping further than the girls, and the furthest throwing, furthest jumping boys, farther than the first, furthest throwing, furthest jumping girls. And then I've got a second paper there where I looked at the National Club Swimming Association national championship data for, I think it was 10 years, if I remember right. In the short course events, there's 12 different events. The boys were statistically faster than the girls in 8 of those 12 events. And there was one event where it was real close. It was a P of 0.055. So real close to it. The other three, the girls weren't faster than the boys. And so either the boys were faster than the girls or was not difference, but still showing male athletic advantages. Another paper that is out there, this is Mara Atkinson. I met her at ACSM in last June. You'll notice Sandra Hunter, she wrote the paper for the ACSM on biological differences or sex differences in sports. Jonathan Setterfield's done some research on this. This paper is available in pre-peer-reviewed form. I'm assuming they're trying to get it published somewhere. But this is out there also. And the great thing about this paper, it confirms what I've published, or I'm confirming what they've put out there. So you have two different groups from totally different universities, not connected to one another, coming up with very similar results. I think we're going to change some things here. I think the books and stuff are going to start changing where people are going to look at it and say, you know what? Maybe the sex-based differences in athletic performance before puberty, maybe it does matter. And maybe we should pay attention to that a little bit more. All right. And so that's the end of my slideshow. And just want to thank everybody for listening to me. I apologize. I'm probably not as entertaining as I was at the Icons Conference. I don't have a can of soda on my desk by me, so I can't spill that. But anyway, I guess now I'll turn it back to Kim.
Oh, no, that was great. It was wonderful to hear from you, Greg. Really excited about the work you're doing and everything that's being published. It's amazing when you close there at the end and say, maybe we'll realize that puberty differences existed before, I mean, pre-puberty difference in performance existed, and we'll get that in books. Like, this is something we all know, we're aware. I mean, those of us who were participating in sport long before, long before we were at the top of our game or even teenagers, we recognize those differences trying to get involved. At least I remember it very well. So,
Yeah, I remember playing kissing tag in recess, and I could always catch the girls.
that's not good. Yeah, I remember quitting soccer because the boys all ran around to try to kick the girls in the shins. And so I was like, I'm gonna go pick a sport where they can't get that. So I would like everyone who has questions to please post your questions in the question and answer. And I will read those off to Dr. Brown. Okay, so first question for you is, can you provide more explanation of the effect of lean body mass on performance? Why? I think that's, I have a question about that too. Why is that so relevant?
Well, I mean, lean body mass, that's the muscles that pull on the bones, right?
Okay.
And you have to pull on the bones to have movement. More lean body mass is by and large more muscle mass, right? Yes, lean body mass also includes the lungs and the organs and stuff like that. But keep in mind, the heart is a muscle, and then we've got our skeletal muscle pulling the bones. And so by having more muscle mass, you can produce more force. By producing more force, your stride length can be longer. Your jumping height can be further. The force you apply to the ball will be higher. And again, this is one of the things that's kind of crazy to me is that's just generally accepted that in adult men, 45% more lean body mass than adult women. And that really does explain a lot of the differences in athletic performance. There are others, of course, with where the body fat is carried and hip structure and cardiorespiratory size. But again, 30 to 70% of our differences in whether it's jump height or running speed or things like that are explained by having more lean body mass. And basically, there's questions on in children, does that come from mini puberty, which is in the first 6 months of life, boys have a boost in testosterone, and does that have some lingering effects, or is it linked to the Y chromosome? And there just hasn't been tons and tons of research looking at that, which again is why so many people have gotten hung up at, well, at puberty, testosterone increases, and you see the huge increase in lean body mass at puberty, which we can see that pretty clearly. In children, it's a little less clear. Part of it does come down to it, the ethics of doing research with kids. How can you get kids that are roughly equally trained, equally aged, and compare their lean body mass when kids grow so much and grow at such different rates? So there are some challenges there. But if you really look at the research on it, the boys do have more lean body mass than girls. Personally, I think it's both mini puberty and the Y chromosome. I think both of them contribute. I don't think it's one or the other. I think they both contribute to the more lean body mass in boys before puberty and, of course,
after
puberty.
They're linked. I mean, you're not, if you've got the Y chromosome and an active SRY gene on it, you're going through the mini puberty. So they're directly linked. I'm not sure they're totally separatable. But we couldn't separate them, honestly. The other thing I was going to say, it was really interesting for me to see that huge percentage in the mini javelin throw. Something I have done a little bit of digging on my own is the difference in throwing between males and females, because our elbow joints are different, our shoulder, you know, that, so that whole throwing motion is a really significant, I can't find it again, but I read an article on physical therapy about rehabilitating injured young girls and women, and how you would treat those from a throwing motion, a shoulder injury or an elbow injury, and you would rehab those injuries differently for females versus males because of the joint. And I thought that was fascinating, but a really big, that throwing motion is really important in my sport, in tennis, obviously, for the serve. And I mean, the men's serves are just monster compared to the women's. And then, but in volleyball, that matters, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of body motion, twisting, core strength, jumping that goes into those motions. But for throwing, you know, a javelin or a ball of any kind, those would be really significant. And that 44% difference so young was really striking. So that's coming out in your next paper, a bigger analysis of that.
So the 44%, that is from the USA Track and Field National Junior Olympic Championship record, comparing the furthest throw for an 8-under boy compared to the furthest throw of an 8-under girl.
Mm-hmm.
In my paper that's coming out, I think it's like 30%, I think is what we had for the difference. So not as high as the, you know, all-time difference, but still, that's huge. And you're right. The difference in throwing between boys and girls, that's one of the earliest appearing differences in whether you want to call it athletic performance or physical fitness. You get a little boy, 2 or 3 year old boy, he's going to throw the ball faster and farther than a 2 and 3 year old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they've even tried to, okay, let's take little girls and coach them to throw like a boy. And they still don't throw as well as the good throwing boys, right? You can teach them to throw better, but you can't.
When I was reading that, it was really interesting. Like, it's actually the physical therapist was describing how it actually has something to do with hip rotation, the alignments of the back. I mean, there were so many differences he was going through and talking about how to preserve and heal injuries in women in, you know, that had sports related. It was, I wish I had kept it, but it was one of those early reads for me. So seeing your statistics there tonight was really confirming for that. There's a really good question, or I mean, a great comment here that someone would like you to elaborate on from Mary. Dr. Brown, she says, well, we know the answer. We think it would be great if you would comment on why, like, papers, and there are some new papers coming out that are trying to normalize performance for cardiac output, lean body mass, and argue that testosterone suppression makes males equal to females if they normalize for lean, like, so saying, like, oh, males and females that have the same lean body mass, or, you know, these other male-female differences, when we normalize for those differences, then they're equivalent. And even still, they're not equivalent. But can you explain why that happens a little?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing, because this is something in exercise science, exercise physiology, we do all the time. If we measure VO2 max, right, maximal oxygen uptake, if we look at it in terms of liters per minute, so that would be absolute VO2 max, men are going to have about a 50% higher VO2 max than women. Well, men also have about 30 pounds more body mass, and, like, I can't remember what it is, like 50 pounds more lean body mass, right? Well, if we account for VO2 max relative to body mass, the difference between males and females goes from 50% to 25%. And so if we express VO2 max in milliliters of oxygen per kilogram of body mass per minute, then the difference between males and females gets half as big as it was. And so then if we actually take VO2 max relative to lean body mass, so if we do measurement of body composition on a man and a woman, measure their oxygen consumption and express the oxygen consumption relative to lean body mass, the difference between males and females gets down to be like 2%. Right. And so that's something we do in a research setting to try and explain why are these sex-based differences? Oh, well, the men have more lean body mass. If we could account for that, our men and women difference, the difference gets a lot smaller. We can do the same thing with cardiac output. Cardiac output is how much blood the heart pumps per minute, right? And so men have larger hearts than women. Well, men are 5 inches taller and 30 pounds heavier than women on average. So of course they're gonna have a bigger heart. So if we take into account for the cardiac output relative to body size, well, then the difference comes down to like, again, 2%. So there's still this lingering difference between males and females, even when we try and account for body size. We see something, some of the transgender advocates for sports, they say, well, we should normalize it for body height, which is not something I see in really any of the sports science research. Okay, you see it occasionally, but not very often. And their argument, well, lean body mass is strongly correlated with lean body height or with body height, which makes sense. Taller person needs more muscle to move their body. The problem with that, there's a couple of things, and Ross Tucker did a great thread on this. I wish I could go back and find it. I haven't found it, but he did a great thread on this explaining this is such a artificial mathematical try and compensate to equalize the playing field between men and women. Why don't we just then say, oh, well, since women are 10% slower than men, we just let them start 10% sooner. Or, you know, if the men and women can't jump as high, let's just give the women a booster seat to jump out of.
Yeah,
you know,
that reminds me of my parents going on runs when I was little, and my dad ran backwards for some period portion of the run, and my mom wouldn't speak to him for 2 days. He was so angry. It's like, don't mock what I'm trying to do here. I'm not the same as you. But yeah, I think what you're saying there is when we, and correct me if I'm wrong, when we normalize for sex, you're normalizing for sex differences. So you're not like, if you're going to take out all of the relevant information that is a differentiator, like that are differentiators between males and females, then you're just basically saying we're ignoring how men develop and how women develop. You're not giving me any meaningful information here. And like, I think it's really interesting that you pointed out there's still a performance difference.
Yeah, there's still,
even when you try to take out all of these factors that are imbued in humans on the basis of sex and we can't undo them, you're still left with a sex-based difference.
Yeah, and some of that comes down to, you know, the differences in fiber type. For a long time, people, it was really controversial, is there sex-based differences in fiber type? And now there's more and more.
Type, you mean in the muscle?
Yeah. Yeah. If you have it basically slow twitch or fast twitch skeletal muscle. And there's more research coming out. Yeah. It's pretty convincingly that, again, the difference is small, but a little difference matters when you're talking about sports performance. When we're measuring things to the thousandth of a second, you know, photo finishes, those types of things. If a man has 53% fast twitch fibers and a woman has 51% fast twitch fibers, even accounting for body height, body mass, all that stuff, you still got the fast twitch fibers, which contract faster, which give more power, more explosiveness. He's got a competitive advantage. And then the other problem with this normalization thing that they're trying to do, that's just not how we do sports. Yeah. I mean, we have weight categories for a reason, but if you put a 150-pound female wrestling against a 150-pound male, she's going to lose probably 9 times out of 10. A lot of people are all excited because there was a female wrestler that won a state championship in her weight class. Okay, so 1 out of 50 states this year.
Well, also, Greg, that was a really unique situation because she was like in the super lightweight category. And so she was wrestling at like 100 pounds or 103 pounds, but so under 110, somewhere in there. Yeah. And the boys that are under that weight are likely prepubescent, right? So they're either prepubescent or they're very, very tiny.
They're tiny boys.
Slightly undeveloped. I watched a couple of the videos of it and they were just, not fully developed yet. So these are like the ninth and 10th grade boys who could make that weight class because they haven't grown up yet. And they're wrestling against a girl who is fully developed. So,
and also I would argue probably if they're wrestling at 106, they're probably cutting weight. They're really dehydrating, which impairs their performance. So if she is at 100, if she's in the 106 pound weight category, normally hydrated, normally fueled and everything, and she's an amazing athlete, and these boys are dehydrated and have impaired their performance, yeah, she probably does have an advantage there that would benefit.
Well, and I would, and they're going to be the less developed. I mean, it's pretty hard for boys to stay that size.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually you don't see very many seniors wrestling in the 106 pound weight class. A lot of times it's your freshmen and sophomores.
Yeah. All right. There's another question for you here, Dr. Brown. So thank you for taking the time to share this information. I don't understand why these decision makers want to go against the information that you've just shared. It's discouraging for females who want to compete, and I hope this things change. So it's not really a question, more of a comment. So thank you for being involved in getting this information out there.
And, you know, honestly, I agree. I'm not, I guess it's my point of view, but I don't understand why the decision makers are trying to basically ruin women's sports by allowing male bodies to participate. Other than there's a lot of pressure. There's been a lot of political pressure, a lot of local pressure about you have to be kind, you have to be understanding, or we're going to sue you. And people get scared when you start throwing lawsuits around. A lot of people are going to back down because they're afraid of getting a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And I think it becomes kind of a, I'll call it a tsunami effect, for lack of a better word. You know, if the school district, one school district over, decides they need to allow a boy to be in the girls' sports so they can avoid a lawsuit, now the next school district feels more pressure to do that. Then the next school district feels even more pressure. And pretty soon, half the school districts in the state are allowing trans girls to compete in girls' sports. And you go along with the crowd because you're afraid of sticking up and getting a lawsuit. You know, I think there's a lot of that going on. And of course, you know, I think we've all experienced, it's not fun to be called a transphobic, hater, bigot, racist, terrible, awful troglodyte.
No, it's not fun, but it is. I mean, I think we're all learning that if we don't stand up for our girls, then girls end up getting hurt. If we don't stand up for women, then there isn't a future for the girls to look at in a way that makes them believe they can be champions and are deserving. So we're getting over that. I wanted to mention, you know, we've seen a couple of male athletes that have been on puberty blockers early on, and they're still having really incredible success, particularly in jumping. And in, I mean, we've seen two male athletes in volleyball competing at really high levels, one that has caused a concussion on a girl, and that throwing motion again and jumping, you know, and their final height certainly doesn't seem to be stunted by it. So I think, is there any, I've, you know, read some of the documents out there, the published journals about puberty blockers and the effects, how they work, keeping the growth plates open, et cetera. And as you're saying, like the male performance isn't put on hold here. These individuals are still going to grow, have the same limb ratios. They're going to have the same muscular make, like, what did you call it? Like, did you say fibers?
Fiber type. Yeah, they're still going to have the same. Yeah, puberty blockers aren't going to, at least as far as we know, they're not going to change fiber type. So if a male has more fast twitch fibers, going on puberty blockers isn't going to change that to now having more slow twitch fibers.
Okay.
Other things like, so when a person is first put on puberty blockers, it does stunt their growth in height a little bit while they're on just puberty blockers. But once they start the cross-sex hormones, then they get back to an accelerated height growth and basically attain their normal predicted adult male or adult female height. So
well,
the puberty blockers,
contrary to what I read in the, there's that scientific paper, trans girls grow tall or whatever. And it's that was explaining that puberty blockers work by holding the growth plates open. So they actually, and that's why they're used in precocious puberty also, is to allow people to reach a taller height.
Yeah. So while they're just on puberty blockers, they're not growing in the height. The growth plates are held open. Mm-hmm. So the growth plates aren't closing off. So then when they go on the cross-sex hormones, they get the accelerated growth that we would normally get at puberty. Mm-hmm. And the growth plates have been held open. which again allows them to reach normal height. And the interesting thing, so trans girls go on puberty blockers, then cross-sex hormones, have normal adult male body height. Trans boys go on puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. They will have pretty much normal adult female body height.
Yeah,
so they don't
I've seen pictures where these girls have gone on puberty blockers and they stay very petite. And mm-hmm. the boys that go on puberty blockers end up being very, very tall.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's not a lot out there looking at lean body mass, but the research on it shows that. So again, going on puberty blockers maybe slows down the growth of lean body mass, but it doesn't erase the difference. So let's say you take a 12-year-old boy, put him on puberty blockers. He might have less lean body mass than a typical 13-year-old boy a year later, but he still has more lean body mass than a typical 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And what does concern me, though, is there's a couple of papers out there where they looked basically at 15-year-olds. Oh, well, puberty blockers don't erase the differences at age 15. Let's try at age 13. Oh, well, at age 13, they didn't erase the differences. Let's try age 11. And they keep trying to back it up. And we do see that where they keep trying to push puberty blockers to an earlier age and an earlier age. Yeah, that I just can't believe that anybody can do that and sleep with themselves at night.
Yeah, I had a great conversation with Jamie Reed and some of the folks in her organization recently about, you know, we're really making a difference in recognizing what's going on in the medical community. But understanding in the sports community, a lot of these policies being developed around saying there's no difference in performance up to a certain age, it's just so important for us to combat that with published work. So thank you so much for all that you're doing. This is great.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to help out as much as I possibly can. And honestly, this really did open my eyes getting involved with this to an area of research that needs to be done. And so it's kind of nice, right? I get the papers so I can continue to keep my job, those types of things. Keep paying the bills, feed the family.
Yep. Well, thanks for sharing it with us. I'd love to have you back on if you would let us know when your future papers are released or for publication. It would be great to hear you go over those with us.
I'd be happy to. And I do want to throw a little teaser out there, though. Hopefully someday soon, we've got a paper coming out with Ross Tucker and Tommy Lundberg and Emma Hilton criticizing the IOC statement where they say, oh, just don't, you know, I can't exactly how they say it, but we should not assume that there's a sex-based difference in trans individuals.
Yes, right.
So that's been accepted for publication.
No presumption of difference between males and females.
Yes.
That was the statement. And it was, on its face, it was like, where have you been?
Yeah. And so there's about 26 of us that have authored on that. Tommy Lundberg really took the lead, him and Ross Tucker, Emma Hilton, Kathy Devine is on that. And again, there's about 26 of us on that. And it's been accepted for publication in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports.
Fantastic.
I keep expecting
again,
it's going to come out.
Please come back on our webinar and update us on all these publications that are forthcoming. It's exciting that you're doing a lot of, sounds like there's a lot of publishing going on.
There is. So,
all right. Do we have any last minute questions here? Oh, yes, we do. All right. Last question for you. Do you know if there's a specific age that an individual would have to get approved for puberty blockers? I don't think that's a question for you. It's kind of state to state. There's differences all over the country. There's plenty of states that are banning that entirely. Certainly there are whole countries that are. So I think that's a different kind of question. So happy to hear this. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Brown. Thank you for being on and sharing your wisdom with us. It was wonderful to see you again.
All right. Well, it's good to see you, Kim. Hope to see you again soon.